On Sunday, September 22nd at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature composer, saxophone player, and occasional pianist, Kenny Garrett. Join us as we discuss points in his career and his latest release, Pushing the World Away. We will also talk to filmmakers Sabrina S. Gordon, Barbara Atty, and Janet Goldwater about Bad Sonia Sanchez and their Kickstarter campaign. That's Sunday, September 22nd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for the evening is Kenny Garrett, but before that, we're going to talk to filmmakers Sabrina S. Gordon, Barbara Atty, and Janet Goldwater, excuse me. And as they talk about their Kickstarter campaign and Bad Sonia Sanchez. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York. Sugar in My Bowl, happening right now.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon, Barbara Atty, and Janet Goldwater. All three persons are responsible for a film on Sonia Sanchez. Now, who's going to tell me the name of that film?
This is Janet Goldwater. So the name of our documentary is Bad Sonia Sanchez, and we took that title from the title of one of her books. Sonia Sanchez, as most of your listeners know, is an amazing poet. One of her books of poetry is called We Are Bad People, and we think Sonia Sanchez is a really bad poet. So we've been working on this documentary for 3 years now, and we're getting ready to try to finish it.
Who wants to tell me about the Kickstarter campaign?
Okay, I guess I can chime in. This is Sabrina Gordon. I am the producer and editor of the film. We launched our Kickstarter campaign on Sonia's 79th birthday. September 9th was Sonia's birthday. And so we wanted to launch the Kickstarter in honor of her birthday. And we have exactly 1 month to get it done. I don't know if all your listeners are familiar with Kickstarter, but basically you have to raise all of the money within about a month. And you have to raise all of it to get any of it. So it's definitely an all or nothing scenario. So far, people are really excited about the film. As you know, she has a lot of fans, a lot of students, a lot of people who really love her work. And one of the things that people say quite often whenever they hear about the film is like, oh my gosh, they're so excited that Sonia is getting this kind of recognition, that her work and her legacy as an activist and as a writer is being honored and recognized and celebrated in this way.
I understand you're talking to lots of people. Does anyone want to give away what we have to look forward to?
Sure. This is Barbara. I'll give it away. And I also want to add something that the film, it's been shot, totally shot, and so we're looking for funds to do the final editing and post-production for the film. And so that's what the Kickstarter money will go to. So we actually have interviewed incredible people for this documentary. Sonia Sanchez has been an inspiration and a mentor to so many multi-generational spoken word artists, poets, and rappers and hip-hop artists. And we've interviewed Questlove of The Roots and Black Thought of The Roots, Talib Kweli, Jessica Kerr Moore, Ursula Rucker, all really talented young artists who cite Sonia Sanchez as their mentor. We've interviewed her peers in the Black Arts Movement from the 1960s, Amiri Baraka, Haki Madhubuti, Nikki Giovanni. Sabrina, who else am I leaving out here?
Well, we also just interviewed Ayanna Mathis.
Oh, and Ruby Dee. One of the unique things about our documentary is that we have a lot of people reading Sonia's poetry in addition to Sonia Sanchez herself. So that includes Ruby Dee and many of the people that I just mentioned.
This documentary, is it more of a biographical documentary or is it more of a recognition of her body of work? Or both?
This is Janet. We're actually trying to do both. And because Sonia Sanchez's work has been, throughout her career as an artist, has been wrapped up in her personal life and her political life, it's very hard to separate the work from the artist. And so we're telling her story from a young child in Birmingham when she lost her mother at a young age and suffered from a serious lisp and then discovered that she could express herself with the written word, to somebody who became a political activist and one of the founding pioneers of the Black Arts Movement. So we're tracing her life to who she is today, a 79-year-old, extremely engaged artist, and we're tracing it through her work and through her memories. So we're letting her read the work that reflects those periods, as well as Barbara mentioned, letting other artists read and interpret her work. It's a very exciting combination of performance and memoir.
So I take it that you're also going to cover Dr. Sanchez's work as an educator.
Yes, definitely we'll cover her work as an educator. She started teaching at San Francisco State, where she, among a few other people, was one of the leading innovators in bringing African-American studies to universities. And she's taught at the University of Pittsburgh, Amherst, for many years at Temple University. And she's also gone around the country giving workshops, lecturing, mentoring. There are so many young poets who attribute their motivation to what they learned in her class. So, yeah, that will definitely be a part of the documentary.
I would just add that we have that footage. We have her in the classrooms talking to young people and aspiring writers and so on in the film.
Oh, and for the sake of the listeners, we're talking to Sabrina now, and we were just talking to
Barbara.
As far as the Kickstarter campaign, how long do we have?
Until October 9th. I think that's from the time that you air this. It'll be maybe about 2 weeks left into the campaign.
Okay. And so how do we get access to this Kickstarter campaign to help this documentary happen?
So you want to go to Kickstarter.com, put in Sonia Sanchez, and you will go directly to our page. Give whatever you can. Every bit counts. And make sure that all your friends and colleagues and people that share your commitment to art and history and poetry and all good things, make sure that your friends see this page too. It can happen if we get it out to our village.
Okay, Janet, could you repeat the coordinates again?
Yeah, so we're going to ask your listeners to go to Kickstarter.com. Once they're there, they put in Sonia Sanchez, and it will go directly to our page.
Excellent. Is there anything else that either Barbara, Janet, or Sabrina would like to add?
Well, this is Sabrina, and I would just like to add in regard to the campaign that when you make a donation, I just wanted to point out that there are some really cool thank you gifts.
Ah, yes.
Make donations, including stuff from Sonia Sanchez's personal collection, and there are even some experiential awards with her. Like she's offering to do a consultation with a limited number of people who would like her to read their poetry, and there's also a big event coming up that if you donate at that level, you are our special guest at this event. So there are a lot of exciting cool things on there once you check it out.
When's that event happening?
This is Barbara. Yes, the event is happening in Philadelphia on Wednesday, November 6th. It's a conversation with the poet laureates, and it's going to be Sonia Sanchez, Toni Morrison, and Rita Dove. Very exciting.
Wow, wonderful. Okay, everybody, you've got your orders. You know what to do. And I'd like to thank Barbara Eddy, Janet Goldwater, and Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon for joining Sugar in My Bowl to tell us about BAD.
Sonia Sanchez.
Thank you so much, Joyce.
Thanks, Joyce.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And what we're listening to right now is Detroit. Seeds. This is from Seeds from the Underground. It's a 2012 Mac Avenue release. And it features Kenny Garrett, who written everything and arranged everything on this release. On alto and soprano sax, piano on some recordings on this release. On bass is Nat Reeves, drums Ronald Bruner, and Rudy Bird on percussion. Not on this cut, I guess. Not on this cut. And Benito Gonzalez on piano. And the vocals is Nedelka Prescott. And This is Detroit, because Kenny Garrett's from Detroit. Before that, we heard an exchange with Sabrina S. Gordon, Barbara Eddy, and Janet Goldwater, who are the filmmakers behind BAD Sonia Sanchez. Go to the Kickstarter. Go to Kickstarter.com and look for Sonia Sanchez, and you will find information about that documentary and how to help it happen. Stay tuned for more. I'm going to make my apology now. I'm going to play a Miles Davis song later. I feel bad about it, but that's when we're going to hear from the Bandstand with Hank Williams. But stay tuned. This is a very enlightening show, and Kenny Garrett is no joke. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the phone with
Kenny Garrett.
Hi, Kenny Garrett. Thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. That's the name of this program.
Okay. So good.
And thank you so much for all of the music that you've brought us over the years.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Primarily, I mean, we'll talk more about it later, but I definitely want to thank you for your latest release, Pushing the World Away, and the title cut in particular.
Okay. Okay.
But we'll start at the beginning, I guess. You were born in Detroit?
That's correct.
Do you want to tell us about the beginnings of Kenny Garrett in Detroit?
The beginnings of Kenny Garrett in Detroit. Well, you know, my father played tenor saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how it actually kind of came about. I used to love the smell of the case. So when he would practice, I would sit by the saxophone case. Not that I wanted to play the saxophone. And that every day would draw me in and I would go sit by. And eventually he bought me a plastic saxophone for one of the Christmas. And then if I played around with that, he bought me another, a real alto saxophone that had a bullet hole had been soldered. So I'm not sure where he got it from, but that was my first alto. He taught me the G major scale, and they sent me off to the music school. I started, you know, to hang out with some of the locals in Detroit, like Marcus Belgrave, who is a pillar of the community in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the musicians who took me under his wings and exposed me to the big band. He had a big band that had so many bad cats in that band. Initially, I actually played in the trombone section because they already had five bad saxophone players. And there were so many musicians who wanted to play in Marcus's big band. So I learned how to transpose the trombone music by sitting in the trombone section. You know, and I used to, you know, practice with trombone players from that, what I learned. Marcus Belgrave was definitely instrumental in my development as a musician coming to Detroit. And so I ended up playing in Marcus's big band and then eventually playing in this smaller band, which I got a little bit more attention and started learning about more the tradition of playing saxophone and playing Charlie Parker's music and Monk's music, and that was just a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another person by the name of Bill Wiggins, who was actually my high school band director, who's the one who told me about Marcus.
Oh,
you
okay.
Know, you know, yeah, and Bill Wiggins was it was a great saxophonist. He was my high school teacher, so I'd study private lessons with him. But I always tell people I never heard him play any solos, but, I mean, he was just a great teacher. And he exposed me to the music of Aretha Franklin and Jerry Butler, and he would invite me to come out and just check out the music. And basically what he was doing is planting the seeds for me to learn, you know, to be able to play, to sub for him in, you know, whatever capacity, if it was doing a show, if it was a big band, or if it was just playing. Matter of fact, I'm moving a little quick, but I'll come back. When I was playing in the Ellington Band, he was in the Ellington Band at the same time, which was a strange situation. Now you have your teacher in the same band you're playing. You know? And that was some strange stuff. But, you know, it worked out. I mean, he was still the teacher. I couldn't hang with him. He's like, he's still over there. And his tenure was really short. He didn't stay that long, but it was a great thing, you know. And this, you know, growing up in Detroit really just helped me to hear so many different genres of music, you know, hearing the Motown sound and hearing avant-garde music and having guys teach you about Charlie Parker, you know, older musicians like Lamont Hamilton. There were so many great musicians. I mean, I always tell people something in the water where there's so many musicians who were playing, and what I hear and how I express my music is really because of Detroit. You know?
You actually did a tribute to Wiggins on Seeds to the Underground?
That's correct.
Thank you. That was really nice of you.
Well, you know, I think it's very important, at least for me, that I'm always, you know, trying to thank people while they're here.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't get a chance to do that for Wiggins, but I think, you know, my thing I've learned is that we have no idea what happens afterwards. No one has come back to say anything. So I think for me, I like to do the tributes to why people are here, and
right.
I like to thank musicians because, I mean, so many. There's some who had a little part, but that part turned out to be the most important part. You know?
So how did you wind up in the Ellington Band?
Actually, I was the up-and-coming saxophonist in Detroit. I was playing the Marcus's Big Band. I was playing with Lyman Woodard, organ trio. And when they came to Detroit, their saxophone player, who was playing at that time, just disappeared.
Hmm.
And so they were looking for a person to come in and play. And everybody recommended me. Bill Wiggins recommended me, who was my teacher, and Marcus Belvey recommended me. And I was just going to go out, really just for a couple of gigs. And those couple of gigs turned into like 3 years and a half. And
right.
And the whole thing, you know.
You had exposure to Cootie Williams?
Oh, yeah. Well, Cootie Williams, yeah, I mean, he was the one. I mean, Cootie Williams was really pretty interesting. Because, you know, when you're playing in those big bands, I guess they have this custom. When you're a rookie or you're a younger musician, you're supposed to sit in the back of the bus. Well, I didn't know that. I mean, I was coming out of high school, so I didn't know anything about that. I just got on the bus, and there was an open seat, and it was like the fourth seat on the left side of the bus. And so I just sat there. And right across from me, there was Cootie Williams. So first of all, they were trying to tell me, well, you're not supposed to sit there. But I mean, by that time, I'd already sat there. So I was thinking, well, this is probably the seat I'm supposed to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But Cootie Williams came out of retirement at that time. And we were in Australia. We were in Japan. And he used to always encourage me to write my own music.
Mm.
He'd always say, you know, he would call me Cookie Baby.
Oh.
He called me Cookie Baby because what happened, I was young. I used to have this grocery bag full of cookies. And when the sugar would go down, he would say, Cookie Baby, let me get some of those cookies. And I'll just pass a bag over to him. And he would eat some cookies and pass them back over to me. And that was it. And I, you know, so, yeah. And so, no, not many people know that story. But what ended up happening, I would sit, you know, sometimes I was sitting and playing, you know, Stanley said, well, Cookie Baby, he said, well, write your own songs. And also Miles. Miles also, you know, I'll be telling you, write my own composition. But, you know, Cootie just, you know, I guess he heard something and he felt that it was important to express that, you know.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, glad I had a, you know, chance to play with him. You know?
Now, you didn't have formal training as far as you didn't go to university and all that other business. How did you learn how to write?
I don't think it was really anything that was so profound. I just basically, I mean, I used to always, when I was in high school, I was trying to write my own song. I think one of the first songs I wrote, I can't remember the name of it, but it was with Marcus's Big Band.
Okay.
It was arranged, but I hadn't bought a song, and I was trying to write. I think for me, it was just more going off of intuition and the feeling of things and orchestrating things. I'm only sure there's certain ways and certain things I can learn, but for me, I just went off, you know, of my feeling of what I thought, you know, how the order of the chords were going and the melodies. I always thought it was important to have melodies in the songs that people can remember, because I always would hear people say, well, you know what, the jazz musician, we don't know what the melody is. And they'll go and try to find a record, but they don't know the melody. So I said it's important. And of course, I love melodies anyway, you know, by playing with Miles. And I always thought it was important to have melodies. So it was never difficult to come up with the composition. It was basically trying to make sure that all the tunes are not running together.
How did you learn structure and I mean, I know you're saying it's intuition, but how do you communicate this to your fellow musicians?
Well, I mean, that part is easy. Of course, I know theory and harmony and all that stuff. I mean, I didn't study in a university, but I did. My university was the Duke Ellington University,
yeah.
The Miles Davis University,
Shaw,
Freddie Hubbard. So those were my universities. I learned how, from playing other musicians' compositions, to, you know, how to formulate and put a song together. You know, of course, and I listened to all genres, so I was able to just take different things and put them in the music, put them in my songs.
Now, since you were in the Ellington Band, did that expose you to all of the other opportunities that opened up for you? Like playing with Woody Shaw and Freddie Hubbard and Art Blakey and et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I met a lot of those musicians by traveling.
Okay.
The relationship that I developed with Freddie was actually through Marcus Belgrade.
Oh.
Freddie came to Detroit, and Marcus was telling him, this is a young and up-and-coming guy, watch out for him. And when I got to New York, I actually hooked up with Freddie. You know, it took a minute, but I eventually hooked up with him, sat in with him, and ended up getting the gig with him. And the same thing, when I played with the Mel Lewis Orchestra, same thing in Detroit, I met some musicians. I met at General's and Mel Lewis. I met some of the musicians when I was still in Detroit in high school, you know, just hanging out. And some of the other opportunities happened when I eventually moved to New York, where I met Danny Richmond through Jack Wallraff, and, you know, I ended up playing in that band for a while. So, I mean, a lot of the opportunities came by, you know, coming to New York or meeting people, you know, prior to getting to New York.
How did you wind up working with Woody Shaw?
Actually, working with Woody Shaw was interesting. My roommate, they actually both have passed away, the late, great Morgan Miller
mm-hmm.
and Tony Redis.
Yes, the drummer.
They were playing in Woody's band, and I, you know, because I was a roommate, I was always going to the gigs. And at that time, Woody wasn't looking for, he wasn't looking for an alto player, because he had all the tenor players in there. And so at one point, his girlfriend, her name was Teresa, I'm not sure her last name, she liked the way I played. And so Woody, he decided that he would check me out. And I ended up playing with Woody. I think Carolyn Carrington was in the band, Steve Turay, David Williams, and Stanley Cowell.
Okay.
That was the band that I played in. So I ended up playing with him. You know, just, I mean, of course I was there, but it was just the timing of it.
Those musicians wound up on your first release introducing Kenny Garrett, Woody Shaw, Mogro Miller, Nat Reeves, and Tony Redis.
That's correct.
You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl's name of this program. Kenny Garrett is the guest and featured artist of this program. However, this particular song from introducing Kenny Garrett's debut as a leader, the Kenny Garrett Quintet, is titled Redis's Dance, and it is written by Kenny Garrett for Tony Redis, the drummer. And according to his partner, Janice Grice, today would have been Tony Redis' birthday, so I included this song in honor of Tony Redis. Tony Redis on drums, Nat Reeves on bass, Mogro Miller on piano, Woody Shaw on trumpet, flugelhorn, and Kenny Garrett on alto sax, but he was actually, there was a flute exchange going on that song that had just played, titled, what was that? Oh, no, that's this one. Oops, I'm sorry. Yes, that's introducing Kenny Garrett. And before that, we had from Double Take. That's what it was. And there was a flute exchange going on between Woody Shaw and actually, it was Kenny Garrett on flute. Anyway, Freddie Hubbard. And Woody Shaw, Double Take. It's Freddie Hubbard on trumpet and flugelhorn. He was playing flugelhorn on that recording. Woody Shaw on trumpet. Kenny Garrett on flute on that recording. Alto sax on others. Mogro Miller on piano. Cecil McBee on bass. And Carl Allen on drums. Before that, we heard... Let me say, the name of the title was Just a Ballad for Woody from the Double Take. And here's Woody Shaw in the background right now. That was written by his girlfriend at the time, Teresa. And let's see, before that we heard Wiggins from Seeds from the Underground. And before that we heard Detroit from Seeds from the Underground. And let's get back to this song right to now, Redis's Dance. And rest in peace, Anthony Redis.
Yeah, well, you know, Woody, I think, you know, there was a quick growth that he heard, because I remember one time we were rehearsing for introducing Kenny Garrett. He said, "Man, what have you been doing?" And I mean, I'm busy. I just had been checking him out and Joe Henderson. You know, and because, and Bobby Hutchinson and McCoy, those are my heroes, you know.
Okay.
And so I've been just trying to check those guys out. And then, you know, when he came to play with me, I was honored. Because I didn't get paid for the record day because I gave him all my money, but I was still just honored, you know, that he played on my record, you know.
Nice. Now, you mentioned Bobby Hutcherson as somebody who, I don't know, inspired you, I guess?
No, that's my man. That's my mentors. I think, you know, it's, I always tell people, if I didn't have my own band, I don't want to play with Bobby Hutcherson or McCoy Tyner, because I think the lessons that they could offer me and the way I hear the music and, the way that they present the music, for me, that would be the ideal situation. I have to tell you a story about Bobby. I, was trying to get together with Bobby. So I was calling, you know, I must have called Bobby for like 2 years. And every time I would call him, he'd say, "Yeah, man, well, come on out. Let's go fishing." I'm thinking, "Bobby, I don't want to go fishing. I want you to tell me about some music." You know? And I kept calling and kept calling, and eventually we had a conversation, and it was a long conversation. He talked about, you know, music that he listened to and what he likes, and still, you know, invited me to come out and go fishing, and I still haven't been fishing yet, you know. And I ended up writing a tune called "Conversation with Hutcherson." I think it's on Simply Said. I mean, for me, Bobby, he's one of the musicians who puts the music on such a high level. And that's what I aspire, you know, to try to raise the bar and try to live up to the legacy that our forefathers have, or the precedent they set for the music.
Sure. You eventually wound up recording with him on Skyline.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
With another Detroit person, Jerry Allen.
Thank you.
Actually met Jerry Allen. Well, Jerry Allen wasn't in Detroit. I was there. She was already in Howard. She was in D.C. And she was actually doing, I think she was doing something in Pittsburgh at one of the universities there. And so the first time I met her, I was like 17 years old.
Wow.
And I met her with Wallace Roney.
Okay.
And because she used to come back, you know, like, you know, during the winter solstice or the summer solstice. So I ended up meeting her at that time. And, of course, you know, because we had the same teacher, Marcus Belgrave, we just ended up playing on and off, you know, together over the years. You know, I played on her CD. I can't think of the name of the CD. And Marcus was on that CD. But Jerry Allen is a bad lady.
Yeah. And you were with Wallace Roney with Art Blakey.
That's correct. Wallace Roney, we go way back. I met him when I was 17 years old, and then him being a protege and, you know, he loved the music of Miles Davis, we kind of connected again, not only by playing through Blakey, but when I started playing with Miles, he was always asking me stories about Miles and that kind of thing, and he was, you know, he's always around anyway, you know, in his life. He's really playing the trumpet. Well, he's an underrated trumpeter in my eyes, you know.
Is he also how you wound up working with Cindy Blackman?
Yeah, I've definitely, that relationship, I would say, yeah, that definitely meant a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 22nd. This is the segment of the show where we bring you aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. Tonight's guest, Kenny Garrett, is currently touring Europe to support his Pushing the World Away release, but look for him November 9th at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey. More details on that as the date approaches. This week, however, several Suge guests have area shows for you to catch. Vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater stars as Billie Holiday in the musical Lady Day, now in previews at the Little Schubert Theater on West 42nd Street. Go to LadyDayTheMusical.com for info. That's LadyDayTheMusical.com. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts appears with the Yosemite Terry Quintet at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club on the 24th and 25th of September. See JALC.org/Dizzy's for info on that show. That's JALC.org/Dizzy's. UPenn professor Dr. Guthrie Ramsey, host of our Blues Journey special, reads from his new book, The Amazing Bud Powell, Black Genius, Jazz History, and the Challenge of Bebop, 7 o'clock on the 27th in room 754 of Columbia University's Schermerhorn Extension, 120th in Amsterdam. Go to IRAAS.com for more details. That is IRAAS.com. Pianist Jerry Allen performs a series of concerts featuring the Afro Blue Vocal Ensemble of Ellington's Three Black Kings, honoring the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark and the State Theater in New Brunswick from the 27th to 29th of September. Go to njsymphony.org. That's njsymphony.org. Jerry Allen also appears with the Marcus Belgrave Quartet at the Jazz Standard on October 1st. See jazzstandard.net for info on that show. That's jazzstandard.net. Organist John Medeski has three upcoming shows with John Zorn. They'll be at Columbia University's Miller Theater on September 27th and two shows at Manhattan's Le Poisson Rouge Club on Bleecker on the 29th. See Zorn at 60, the number 60.com for info on those shows. That's Zorn at 60.com. Vocalist Diane Reeves will be at the Tarrytown Music Hall on the 28th of September. See TarrytownMusicHall.org for info. That's TarrytownMusicHall.org. Organist Akiko Saruga and her trio is at The Garage, 99 7th Avenue South on September 28th. See GarageRest.com for info. That's GarageRest.com. Pianist Vijay Iyer has three upcoming shows at the Alexander Kasser Theater at Montclair State University in New Jersey. He has a free talk on October 2nd and performances of his Open City Large Ensemble on the 4th and 5th. Go to peakperfs.org/calendar. That's peakperfs, P-E-R-F-S.org. Last show's guest, pianist Michelle Rosewoman, and her new Yoruba ensemble will be at Dizzy's Club on Monday, September 30th and Tuesday, October 1st. Bassist Reggie Workman will be at the Jazz Standard as part of an ensemble celebrating Art Blakey's legacy on October 3rd through the 6th. See jazzstandard.net. Finally, Dizzy's Club presents Sun Ra Turns 100, with Marshall Allen conducting the Sun Ra Orchestra on October 5th. See jalc.org/dizzy's. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click on the link for the blog. You can also find tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows on the main website. Finally, a reminder that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help keep us and your other favorite shows on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, where you can also become a WBAI buddy by pledging monthly, or pick up sugar premiums you might have missed. This is Hank Williams signing off, and I'll see you next time, Sunday, October 6th, on The Bandstand.
All right, now you have to tell the story, because everybody has one. How did you get the call from Miles Davis?
Well, you know, actually, I was there are two stories, but I was auditioning for a French movie with a tenor saxophonist by the name of Gary Thomas. And he said, well, Miles is looking for an alto player. Are you interested? I said, well, of course I'm interested. That's Miles Davis. But at the time, I was playing Art Blakey. So I called Miles, and his valet picked up the phone, and he said, well, Miles is not here. Leave your number, and he'll call you back. So later that day, I got a call, and I'm like, oh, man, this is not Miles Davis. This sounds like Mulgrew Miller pretending to be Miles. Because he used to always pretend to be Miles. So I didn't think it was Miles. I'm like, oh, that's not Miles. So I'm kind of playing around a little bit. You know, he's like, hey, Kenny, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm like, ah. So eventually I said, well, man, but I said, Mulgrew's got pretty good. If this is, you know, I definitely knew I'd called out to California. But then eventually, you know, I realized that it was Miles. And he said, well, you know, send me some music. So I sent him some music that I recorded with OTB and Art Blakey and some more music I've been working on myself. And then he called me back and said, if I can do it, I can't do it, I can do his voice. He said, Kenny, you sound like you're winning Sonny's test, 30 draws.
Oh, no.
So that was the beginning. Then I ended up going out. My original plan was to go off with like 4 gigs. And my history with Miles is the microphone never worked, you know.
Oh,
so,
no.
So we played, and I remember the first time he heard me, because the first couple of gigs, I would play, but the mic wasn't working. So he finally heard me, and he took off his sunglasses, and he looked at me and said, what? you know, like, what is that? And he's looking at me, and so that was the beginning, you know, of the relationship. And I went on to play with Miles for 5.5 years, and I learned so much, you know, from him, you know, musically and, you know, business-wise, you know, things to do. But I think the main thing is that, I mean, he wanted me to stay true to being myself, mm-hmm. you know.
What was the second story?
The second story was that when I joined the band with Miles, he said he was looking for me because I had done this video at the Berlin Jazz Festival with Dizzy Gillespie, Freddie Hubbard, and Woody Shaw.
Wow.
And Miles told me he saw me on there and he was looking for me. But I guess he didn't know exactly the saxophone player would play with those group of musicians. So I always like to tell both the stories because, you know, you always want a musician to be looking for you.
Right.
Yeah. I'm glad he told me that, though.
Excellent. Now, you did a tribute, Sketches of MD, Live at the Iridium, featuring Farrell Sanders.
Not really a tribute. It was basically I've been playing with Farrell. We were doing Beyond the Wall, and I wanted to document Farrell and I.
Okay.
I mean, that's another one of my heroes. You know, I always feel honored, you know, and blessed to stand on the bandstand with Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
He stood on the bandstand with John Coltrane.
Right.
And we sometimes we're playing in the same register. We start to hear the same notes, and so he'll go high to start playing like alto, and I go low to start playing like a tenor because we just kind of find those same notes. You know,
uh-huh.
I've always been an admirer of Farrell Sanders. You know, because I've always loved his music, and his music comes to me. I mean, through me. I mean, I just hear Farrell. I hear Farrell, uh-huh. Hill Train, all those guys, you know, come through my music, you know. So Sketches of MD was basically just a way for us to get together and record some more.
Okay.
And I just actually wrote out some sketches, and when we played at the Iridium, I just kind of said, let's try this and see what happened. So I just had a friend of mine to come and record it, and that's what happened.
Thank you. You played with Cedar Walton.
That's correct. Yeah, that's true. Actually, I was trying to tell them, actually, when I first got the deal, probably that first year I remember playing in that band. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a long time ago, you know, but that's another one out here is that we lost. Mm-hmm. You know, and I, man, I just, when you mentioned that, I was thinking about the CD. It's been such a long time since I thought about that, but, I don't know if actually I played with him after that, but I never recorded that CD. And of course, I was trying to get together with him and talk about music. I'm always trying to get together with the elders and talk about, you know, concepts and about music, you know. I don't call them lessons because they don't like to do that.
Actually, that's one thing that I really appreciate in all of the information that I'm gathering with regard to you, how you like to make the connection between the elders and how you always want to make sure that connection is there.
Well, I feel that it's very important.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, without the elders, it's not even possible for us to do what we're doing. And we get to a point where we've learned some lessons, and that's great, but we all need to reach out, you know,
right,
to them. I mean, I speak to Sonny Rollins, mm-hmm, not on a daily basis, but I stay in touch with him because, you know, he's one of the musicians that I feel that, you know, he's 83 now.
Right.
And, you know, it's different. Sometimes they're by themselves trying to figure this thing out, but he's still giving it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been doing this for a long time, and, you know, we forget that it's a hard road. And I just always like to stay connected with him. I always felt it was important. And not only that, on all my records, I needed their approval.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I did introducing, I needed the elder, because if I'm going in the wrong direction, they can say, okay, hey, come on, young man, come on back in here. So then I had, Ron Carter and
right,
Elvin Jones on African Exchange students. So I'm always trying to have the elders there to keep me moving in the right direction. Because, you know, as a young musician, you're always trying things, and that's great. But, you know, they can at least instill some of those things, and you can decide if that works for you or not.
And also on Pushing the World Away, you have, I don't speak French, but it's a homage to Sonny Rollins.
Right, Juve. Yeah.
Thank you. Juve.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what it sounds like, too, Juve.
Right. Yeah, but that's, you know, my man. But, you know, like I said, I even my record, Triology, I dedicated to, mm-hmm, Sonny Rollins and Joe Henderson. So, you know, the elders are really important to the music, like I said, and we have to acknowledge them while they're here. And,
right.
And, you know, and realize that, you know, they've been in the trenches and they've been doing this thing and they paved the way for us. So it's important. You know, and I think the young musicians of the day have to realize that it's important to connect with the elders. Sometimes we can get a little lost trying to find, you know, going out by ourselves. So we need to connect,
right,
and, you know, try to, you know, get those lessons.
Five-piece band. Tell me about that experience.
Well, a five-piece band, you know, that was a great experience for me, you know, to play with Chick. Chick Corea, we actually just go back. I played with him with the Bud Powell band with Roy Haynes and Christy McBride.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Wallace was in that band too.
Okay.
Chick is another one of those people that I call and play something on the phone, and he'll play back, and, you know, I'll play something on the piano, he'll play something back on piano, mm-hmm, and we call it blowing, and so we just get together. And so we've always had that relationship. And so when he was thinking about doing the five-piece band, he said, well, I want you to do this. So he called me actually a couple of years in advance to say, you know, how is your schedule? I want you to really do this band, you know. So it was great. It was a great experience. What I found interesting, I had never played with John McLaughlin, and it was really good for me to do that because I learned a lot. You know, he's into a lot of different languages. I like languages, you know.
Right.
And he's into Indian. You know, I'm into world of music too, but he's into,
right,
Indian music. And he was, you know, teaching me about ragas and different things. And,
uh-huh,
different times and all that stuff. So it was really good because some of that came out on Seeds from Underground, like a Seed itself, you know, it's some sections in there, there's seven and different, you know, odd meters. So that was a great experience for me. And we toured for about a year on and off to play with Christian McBride and to play with Brian Blade and Denny Colaiuta.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, a great experience because it was different drummers and it was a different canvas to, you know, to play over. So, I mean, I had a great time.
Tell me, how do you find your members?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, they kind of come to me because, you know, when I think about it, I mean, a lot of the drummers have been through me. You know, I actually met Brian Blade when he was playing at the Village Vanguard with Harry Connick Jr.
Wow.
But Harry couldn't sing. They wouldn't let him sing over at the Vanguard, so I went down and checked him out. Now Lorraine would let him sing. He had to just play the music. So I heard this little drummer. I said, who is this? So I brought him over to the house and checked him out, but he was still in school, and I didn't want to take him out of school.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he just, you know, he had all the elements that I was looking for from the drummer. And at that time, I think I had an African exchange student out, and we ended up going, I brought him to Japan. And then eventually he graduated from college, and then I ended up recording Black Hope with Brian Blade and Kenny Kirkland and Trinette Moffitt and Joe Henderson. So basically the musicians come looking for me. And then, of course, by Brian playing, no one knew of Brian at that time because Brian actually played with me first and on Black Hope, and then people started to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Another drummer is Chris Dave, who played with me. And he, of course, he's gone on to play with Maxwell and Robert Glasper. And, you know, he was looking through me. So he came, recommended through Foley McCray, the lead bassist with Miles Davis, who was saying, there's this young drummer, want to play with you. So, you know, I checked him out in Minnesota, and then I brought him to Europe when he played with me. I mean, all the guys have kind of pretty much come through. I mean, there's, to tell the story, I'm sure it's a long story, but, you know, through Chris, there was Jemiah Wims, they were all from Houston, and then there was Eric Holland, who I met through, you know, through Chris.
Okay.
And then there was there's Kendrick Scott who came through there, there's Mark Simmons, then everybody's coming, you know, then there's Ronald Bruner, who I actually met at Catalina's in Los Angeles. His father's a great drummer. And so when I was in the dressing room, I heard somebody playing the cymbal. I said, who is this guy playing? And I said, I like his cymbal beat. And so he was very enthusiastic young man, and he was like, yeah, man, I want to play with you. I know your music. I know all the stuff, Chris Dave stuff, you know, I want to play. I said, yeah, I don't know if this guy is ready. So I ended up, we did a couple of gigs in Philly, I think D.C., and I'm not sure what the other place was. And he sounded good, but he wasn't used to playing with bands. He was all over the place. I mean, the audience loved him, but he was all over the place. And he wasn't quite ready, so I sent him back. And then probably about a year later, I went back, and I heard him again. He said, I'm ready now. And I took him out because I felt it was important for me to give him a platform to develop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took him to Europe for about a month and just let him play. And I just started encouraging him and trying to, you know, instill some information for him, you know, records to check out and things like that, and, you know, how to think about music. So it's so many people, I mean, that came to the band. But mainly what I'm looking for in a musician is, you know, the drummer's cymbal beat, the bassist, you know, pulse and his beat, and the piano player's touch, and the chords and the voices that he's using, you know, and conceptually, if they're hearing, they don't have to hear exactly what I'm hearing, but if there's something that I hear in them that I think that, you know, we can work with, then I go with them and just try them and just see how they work. You know.
Now, your present band, the members of your band presently?
I'm using McClinty Hunter on drums, Corcoran Holt on bass, Vanell Brown on piano, and Rudy Bird on percussion.
Now, Rudy Bird, I never heard of him until I saw him with you at Garvey Park for the Charlie Parker Jazz Festival. And I had so much fun just listening to him sing and play with you. I really enjoyed his being a part of your group.
Yeah, we played together with Miles Davis.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
We played with Miles, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, I've always wanted to have a percussionist.
Mm.
And not only does that, but he, you know, comes in and he, because he used to play with Lauryn Hill and Lila James and those kind of people. So he basically brings another thing in. Of course, you know, on a lot of my CDs, I like to use voices.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he can pretty much come in and do that part. Because sometimes the overhead gets a little high when you try to bring a singer just for a couple of songs.
Right.
So, you know, he fills that in and, you know, he adds a lot to the band. You know.
Excellent. Is there an instrument that you tend to key in on? Is there an instrument that you vibe with?
I vibe with the piano and the drums.
Okay.
Yeah, I like, I mean, of course I hear the bass, but the piano for the chords and the drums for the rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this latest release, Pushing the World Away. Is there a concept on there, or are you just like, I have some songs, and let's put them together and make them work?
Well, you know, I'm always writing, so it's the title actually came from, you know, I was just so busy. You know, it was so much happening last year, because, I mean, you know, if you think about it, Seeds came out March 2012, and, I mean, I was just so many things going on. It was like two Grammy nominations, German Grammy, it was NAACP, it was Soul Train Award, it was just so much going on, and I was traveling, and, you know, just trying to play, so I was trying to find a way, you know, I was just trying to kind of get away from everything where I could receive the music. And I kept coming, it kind of felt like I had to push the world away, so I started pushing the world away. That's where the concept came from, just really, you know, trying to get some of those distractions out of the way. You know, with today's technology, you got everything just coming at you, and I just really wanted to receive the blessings. And the tune itself became something a little deeper, because after I came up with just the concept of the title, then I started thinking, well, what is this song going to be? And then I just remember, as I was recording the song, I started hearing this chant part.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I was like, wow, what is that? But it was clear to me how it came to me. And I was like, whoa, okay, well, then it started to take on something. And then I was really thinking about...
No, wait a minute. Wait. I hate to interrupt you, but how did it come to you?
Well, basically, I just heard the voice.
Okay.
The voice. I mean, I heard something and he kept saying, oh, yeah, yeah. And I didn't really know what oh, yeah, yeah was.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I started saying, okay, well, that's interesting. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, yes. So when I came up with that concept, I knew that the composition was going to be different, because initially when I came up with the title, I actually saw this image of a light, kind of like the cover, but it was actually a little like a light, not so much the sunlight, but it was a light. And I was thinking, well, there's something a little deeper than just, you know, the title of that is going deeper. And so I wanted to be able, in this composition, to put this energy, positive energy, together. A lot of times we have negative energy, but I wanted to find a way. If I was going to push the world away, I was going to need some help. So there was a chant, and I call it more like a Christian chant. And then I had my friend, Danelle Brown, doing like more of the Buddhist chant. And then I had other ideas that I couldn't get everybody together. I was going to have all these different religions coming together to push the world away.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't get to that point. And then once we put the rhythm of the Buddhist chant, I had another friend of mine who's Jewish. He had a chant, but that pulled him in. I said, well, I need you to go to the upper room, not to where he is, to go where you go. When you're trying to talk to the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really about the song became more than just it being pushing the world away. It was like, well, what do you want it to reflect? I wanted to reflect the presence of trying to get to God, to push the world away. If it's all this negative energy, we're going to need help, you know, because it's just too many things coming at us, you know. And that was the way. So we're still working it. I mean, that's the concept of it. But as we start to play it, you know, hopefully I'll be able to add the other things I'm hearing to bring it to completion.
I gotta say, when we heard it, me and my partner, Hank, when we saw you at the Charlie Parker Jazz Festival and that song was presented, it was transcendent. It was just amazing. I mean, we took the trip with you.
Well, thank you. But that's the whole idea.
Yeah.
And I think, as the creator continues to bless me, that's really the kind of music that I mean, people don't want to hear, but I think when people hear it, I find it was interesting when people hear the drum mm-hmm. or when they hear something that calls to the spirit or it resonates with them to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that most of the people, when they say that they listen to that, then I can tell what they like to hear.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the inclusion of Say a Little Prayer.
Well, Say a Little Prayer, it's kind of interesting. I usually don't do covers so
uh-huh.
much. I just happened to be sitting at the piano, and I just came up with this intro. And the intro somehow started to go to this melody. I knew what the melody was, but I was like, wow, why am I playing this melody? And then it starts to evolve, and it became like this complete picture of these themes. And then it was actually a place for us to improvise. And I was like, well, I wasn't even sure if I was going to use it. It was just an idea, and I liked it. It was just that. And then we were in Italy. This is like last year. We were touring off of Seeds, and I was trying to play it with the band, to show the band. And they were like, oh, wow. And it was the people who worked in the restaurant. And after we played it, they just started applauding. Wow, what is that all about? I said, maybe they know the song. And it happened again. We were in Austria. And I was saying, wow, this is interesting, because I'm kind of playing with the time, stretching a little bit. It's a little, mm-hmm. little elastic. And I thought it would be different because it's not exact melody,
mm-hmm.
And because that's not how I heard it. I just heard like pieces of it kind of flowing. But it seemed like it would be apropos to kind of have that, because if we're trying to push the world away, we need a little prayer. We have to pay a little prayer.
Right.
So it kind of worked out anyway, in retrospect. I said, wow, that's interesting how that song came about. Of course, I used to listen to Aretha Franklin's version of it. Of course, I know Dionne Warwick, but
uh-huh.
that's kind of what was sitting in my mind.
Okay. Tell me about Donald Brown. I've seen his name several times throughout many of your recordings. Who is Donald Brown?
Well, Donald Brown, we played together with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messenger. And Donald Brown is a very prolific writer. When we were playing in that band, he wrote so many great songs, and I just wanted to find a way, if I could just write one song like that.
mm.
And, I was literally just, was in awe just to hear his music. Not the fact that he's a great piano player, but I wanted to find a way to just kind of write music, and then I would write some songs. I would want him to hear it, to see what he thought, because I admired, how he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So when I decided to record my CDs, I said, well, who can I go to who would understand all the genres of music, and I wouldn't have to explain so much about what it is I hear. And it was Donald, because he had written songs. I mean, of course, straight ahead songs. If you sit down with him, he'll play all Stevie Wonder's composition. He'll play all Donny Hathaway. He'll play all the jazz standards. He'll play James P. Johnson, Ragtime. He can play all these different genres. And I was like, man, this is a bad boy. And so I said, well, I need someone like that who can oversee the music. And I never have to say what it is, because he knows. Because we have like minds, because I know he understands it, because we've been working together for a long time, ever since African Exchange Student.
Okay.
And of course, we went on to work with, Songbook, and there's so many, to sign. But,
yeah.
I mean, for me, he's just one of those guys. And when I was writing this song for him, Brother Brown, I want something that was soulful, that it would represent, Donald. That's his personality, And actually, I wrote another song for him, too, called Your Country Nest,
oh.
on African Exchange Student.
Okay.
Thank you.
playing with vocalists, is that different for you, or is that just part of playing?
Well, I think if you're speaking about my music, they're really like a they're like an instrument, because they're not really saying lyrics per se. Mm-hmm. They're just really like another instrument to me. They might be another saxophone, another instrument. Mm-hmm. But I've always heard, when I'm writing my songs, I'm actually singing the songs.
Okay.
So I always hear the voice in my songs. Some of them seem to kind of call for it more. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in the last couple of CDs, people started to hear more, and it started to become part of what they hear, just like the percussion is starting to become more of it, because I always wanted to get it, and people will always say, well, you can't do this, you can't do this. I said, well, no, that's what I need for it to work. And so with the vocals, I think it's just something that I hear. They're not really scatting. It's not mm-hmm. like that kind of composition. It's just basically I'm using them as another instrument.
I'm also thinking of when you played with Al Jarreau in particular. That wasn't your song per se, but just playing with him.
Oh, well, playing with vocals in general is another discipline, because mm-hmm. I mean, you're trying to stay out of the way of the vocalist.
Right.
You know? That was one of my quests, you know, to really be able to play with vocalists. And I haven't had a lot of experience. I recorded with Diane Reeves, and I would love to, you know, just have that opportunity to kind of develop that and learn that discipline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really enjoy how there is always something that you want to learn. That's just perfect.
Thank you.
Is there anything that you want to share about Pushing the World Away that I haven't touched on?
You know, some of the compositions are dedicated to people. I mean, you'll see Hey Chick is one of those compositions. I was really trying to capture the Spanish flamenco kind of spirit of the way the chick likes to play. And then there's Lincoln Center. You know, I've been working over there at Dizzy's Club. And, you know, I like coming through the energy that's around the Columbus Circle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to write something, you know, for that. Of course, Sonny Rollins, that's one of my men, and I just wanted to play something for him. And that's kind of like my St. Thomas. I spent a lot of time in Guadeloupe.
Okay.
Which is probably the first Caribbean's, and I really love to go down there. They play the drums on Saturday, because I remember the first time I went to Guadeloupe, I went there with Miles Davis, and I just loved being there. I just felt so much at home. And then I went back there years later, and the musicians kept saying, you ever heard of Guoca? 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 I said, what is Guoca? And I ended up going on the street first, because I heard these drums are so powerful, so emotional to me, that I had to start backing up, you know.
Mm.
I said, well, can you improvise on it? So they took me to a club. That was kind of like my connection to Africa. I mean, I've been to Africa, but, you know, like I said, sometimes it's just quicker. I can go there for a couple hours on the plane and get down there. And you get that they speak French, and then just learning the rhythm. So, you know, that part started coming in too, you know. So, you know, that's how that song came about. There's a song, huh? Alpha Man, that I wrote for Vernell Brown. He has a way that he plays, and he plays by alphabets. He envisions the letter A, the letter B, and C, so I call him the Alpha Man. So I wanted to write something kind of modern off the way he kind of plays his lines. And then That's It is another song. I'm kind of going all over the place, but That's It is one of those compositions that I wrote about 5 minutes, and I really didn't think anything about it. You know, it was like, okay, well, I didn't think that I was going to record it. And they said, we started to rehearse. I think I was just playing it. And they said, well, what is that? The musician said, what is that? And it was like, well, it's a little song. I play this song. We love that song. And
it's exactly
and then,
5 minutes.
Isn't that something? See, rotation comes about because, you know, I play a little piano. And so when we're on the road a lot, if it's Benito or if it's Vanell, they'll say, well, Benito say, yeah, man, Kenny plays piano, play something. So I go play a line, he'll play a line, kind of the same thing I do. And it was just kind of, it was happening with both piano players. I said, well, man, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a song, and we can all play together. I was going to play piano, too. But what happened when I got in the studio, I was saying, well, if you're in the booth, who's going to cut off the song? Because, I mean, the song, nobody's going to be able to see you, so I just decided to play a little bit and let them kind of play. But I also, I like that song because it's really a lot of love and respect, you know, camaraderie on this CD. Because the musicians really wanted to be there. So there are three drummers playing on this track, rotation, and two piano players, and they're literally rotating.
Wow.
You know, most people don't know there are three drummers, but as one drummer plays, as the other one stops, the other one keeps the cymbal going, and he starts to play. And the three drummers playing, and you know, two piano players playing, and you know, so that's really what I love about the CD is that the camaraderie the guys had and the love that they showed. Because we finished the record, and
so wait a minute, there are three drummers. There's Marcus Baylor, Mark Whitfield Jr., and
Quincy Hunter.
Okay.
They all three are playing
like
they do in church, and the piano players are rotating. And so, and like I said, when the session was over, I mean, they were really just hanging out. It's like, this is their music, you know. And I've done a lot of records, but I have all the musicians feel so invested in the music, you know. And I thought that was a great thing, you know. You know, just a lot of work that went into it. And, you know, I think, you know, that's important for people to know that, you know, I think what makes music good is just having a friendship on the bandstand and off the bandstand, you know. So,
There are two cuts you didn't mention, Chucho's Mambo and Hamasan.
Oh, cool. I almost forgot Chucho. Chucho Mambo. Actually, with Chucho, well, the first thing is that we have the same birthday, Chucho Valdez. And actually, Abel Valdez had the same birthday, too. So we all had the same birthday, which is the opposite night. And we were thinking about, I used to go and see his group. But actually, it was for years, I never could see him because he couldn't get into the country. I'd go to hear him at, you know, some club, and he wasn't there. So finally, I got a chance to hear the band. I said, whoa, man, this music is just, this is it. And so I started, every time he'd come in town, I would try to hook up with him and talk to him. I'd always call him on our birthday and to say hello, you know. And eventually, we were talking about doing a record. So I traveled to Spain, and I was going to Cuba. And we were going to record, you know, musicians, because I'd never been to Cuba, so I wanted to go and, you know, record with the musicians there and do a different record and challenge myself, you know. I mean, I figured, well, I'm going to learn a lot, but at least it'll be good. I can do it in Cuba and take it in and learn something about the culture. And so I got the Cuban visa, but I couldn't get the American visa. I don't know what happened, you know, because President Obama was in office, but I still couldn't get over there. So we decided we were going to do it. We'll try it in Spain. It was a bit much to kind of bring all the musicians to Spain. Right. It was a little costly. So that one didn't work. Then we were going to do it in the States where Chucho was so busy. So I just decided, well, you know, I'll just record the song and maybe I can get Chucho to record on it. But we couldn't get him. We were just so busy, you know. So I decided, well, this is something I hear and this is my interpretation of that, you know. So, and I would love to hear him play it and hear his interpretation, because those guys, you know, that's what they do all day long, you know. So we did the best we can do on it, and it's fun, you know, it's danceable, you know, that kind of thing. And Homasan is actually for a friend of mine's Japanese friend. It's actually for her husband. Homasan is the person, but it's for her husband, the whole family, because Homasan I've been known for a long time. When I was writing the song, I kept hearing she would talk about the culture of Niigata, which that's where she's from. I've never been to Niigata. She said, oh, Niigata, you know, we have the freshest fish, because they're by, you know, by the ocean. We have the freshest sake, this whole thing. And so as I would write this music, I kept thinking about all these things she would say to me. So I said, wow, this is interesting. But at the same time, her and her husband were trying to have a baby, and they were trying to conceive a baby. They were trying everything possible, and it wasn't working out for them. They were having, you know, just one of those things that wasn't working. They must try it five times. And I know that their spirit was very low at that time. And so I was trying to find some way to kind of lift their spirit up and write something that I thought was a beautiful melody and to reflect on life. And so that's how Homasan came up. And I Jean Vega, who's singing on the CD, when she heard these songs, she was crazy. So I said, well, I wasn't really hearing vocals at that point, but when she started singing, I said, well, okay, that's going to be different, you know. So I just had to go with that, you know, the tradition of it, how we you know, usually put the songs together.
Excellent. Well, Pushing the World Away is definitely something that people should get their hands on. It was released on September 17th. And this being the 22nd, and if you don't have it by now, you're slow, and you should get on it. So thank you, Kenny Garrett, for joining Sugar in My Bowl, and I really appreciate all of this time that you shared with us.
Well, thank you, Joyce.
And you are indeed listening to Sugar in My Bowl, and that was, my name's Joyce Jones, and that was my exchange with Kenny Garrett. Woo! Yes. Yeah, we tried to put in a lot in these in this amount of time that we're on. What we're listening to right now is That's All, the 5-minute song from Pushing the World Away. And, man. Yeah, so, wait a minute. Make sure I did what I was supposed to do. We have this thing where we have to record what we're playing and how long we've been playing it. So, yeah. Oh, excuse me. That's it. I said that's all. It's actually called That's It. And it is indeed from Pushing the World Away, Kenny Garrett's release, latest release. It came out on the 17th, as mentioned, September 17th. And this being the 22nd, yes, you need to catch up on yourself. Let's see, Kenny Garrett's on soprano, on alto, who else is on here? Oh gosh, I didn't break this one down.
I did break down Pushing the World Away because I really, you know, the title cut, because I really, really enjoy that. There's McClenty Hunter on drums and Benito Gonzalez on piano and Kenny Garrett on alto sax. And wait a minute, I don't have 5 minutes. Gosh. Let's see, Rudy Bird on percussion. And before that we heard, what did we hear? Your Countryness. That's from Kenny Garrett and African Exchange Student. I'm sort of gathering the information for this. The only thing I have is that Elvin Jones is on drums. Kenny Garrett is on alto sax. And once I have all the proper information, it will be up on Sugar and My Bowl. The playlist entirely will be on sugarandmybowl.org. And let's see, before that we heard Kiss Me Kate, So In Love. Cedar Walton is snippet. Cedar Walton plays featuring Ron Carter and Billy Higgins. Cedar Walton piano. Don Sickler on trumpet. Kenny Garrett on alto saxophone. Lou Ornstein on trombone. Ron Carter on bass and Billy Higgins on drums. And this is on the Delos International label, 1987 release, and Pushing the World Away, of course, released this year, the 17th. And African Exchange Student. Oh, gosh, yes, I'm still putting the list together, sorry. Okay, before that we heard Intro to Africa, Kenny Garrett. Sketches of MD live at Iridium featuring Pharoah Sanders. Kenny Garrett on alto sax, bass, clarinet, and organ and synthesizer on some of these and all at once. Nat Reeves on bass. Benito Gonzalez on piano. And, of course, Pharoah Sanders on tenor, saxophone, and vocals. That's a 2008 Mac Avenue release. Before that, along with the with On the Bandstand with Hank Williams, you heard Amandla. Miles Davis, the title cut. Miles Davis on trumpet. Kenny Garrett on alto sax. Marcus Miller on bass. Keyboards on others. Omar Hakim on drums. Coming up after this is finished will be Homasan, which I thought would be very appropriate. This release is very appropriate because it's to bring about healing and better feelings and positivity. So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And let's see, what do we... Oh, yeah, Omar Hakim on drums, Bashiri Johnson and Don Elias on percussion, Joe Sample, former Sugar guest, on piano, and if you didn't catch him at the Blue Note in his role as Creole Joe, you still have time, he's still traveling, and, you know, you just get out there and do it. This was a Warner Brothers 1989 release. Before that, we heard Who's Got You? Bobby Hutcherson from Skyline. Bobby Hutcherson on vibes. Kenny Garrett on alto sax. Jerry Allen on piano. Christian McBride on bass. And Al Foster on drums. This 1999 Verve release. Before that, we heard Conversations with Hutcherson. Kenny Garrett from Simply Said. Kenny Garrett on alto and soprano sax. Sopranino on something else. Nat Reeves on acoustic bass. Chris Dave on drums. Bashiri Johnson on percussion. And that's a 1999 Warner Brother release. Before that, we heard Rita Stance. And that was in celebration of Kenny Garrett. We're going to... Oh... Take our time. We're going to listen to Homasan and prepare ourselves for La Nueva Alternativa, which is coming up next. Oh, I see some of the fellas already. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. We'll be back on October 6th, and we will also be in fundraising mode. So prepare yourselves to help WBAI. Get out of the financial blahs we're in. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.